Wait for it.
And up it goes. Thank you.
Oh, boy. I needed that little sip of water. Good evening, everybody. My name is Alec. I am an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Sunday Night As Bill Sees It group in Coral Springs, Florida. My sobriety date is June 12, 1990. And I would like to very much thank the committee for asking me to come this weekend. It is my first time here at the lake, and what a way to be introduced to it, you know, to have such an honor and a privilege to speak for all of you tonight. I'm going to do the very best I can to share with you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it is like today. You know, and yes, I will talk a little bit about my drunk log, and the reason I do that is because when I first got to the program of AA and I started going to meetings and stuff, when you guys were talking about steps and solutions and all of that, I had no idea what you were talking about. But when you talked about falling off the bar stool drunk or driving west on the eastbound lane, that was the kind of stuff that I could identify to, so I knew I was in the right place. You know, to start off, I knew very, very early in my life, very young, that I was gay, you know, and I did not have the exposure to gay life that kids have today. You know, I mean, you've got parents who are very accepting, you've got gay proms and all of that kind of stuff. That was not my experience when I went to school. You know, I was the kid who got picked on, I was the kid who got teased, I was the kid who got bullied all the time. And I constantly spent my life lying about who I was and trying to pretend to be something that I wasn't. And it was a miserable way to live. You know, I didn't have parents who really wanted to know about that kind of stuff. I didn't have teachers who wanted to hear about the bullying in school. They just told me to man up. You know, those were the experiences that I had as a kid, and it wasn't fun. You know, so in high school, it was my very first year as a sophomore in high school, a teacher got rather close, kind of took me under his wing, you could say. You know, to anybody out there who has ever been molested, I want to apologize to you now. You know, because what this teacher did to me, legally I understand, yes, he molested me, but what he gave me was something far greater than that. You know, he gave me an opportunity that just for a moment in time, you know, maybe a couple of hours a day or a couple of hours, couple times a week, I actually got to be normal. You know, I didn't have to lie to anybody. I didn't have to feel ashamed about anything. You know, I could actually just be myself and be okay with that. And I could actually know what it was like, at least I thought in my mind at the time, to actually feel loved. You know, I didn't have any of that when I grew up. You know, as if that wasn't enough, when we were seniors at the end of the year, my senior class decided to vote me most likely not to succeed upon graduating high school. They did it in front of the entire senior class and all of the parents. You know, and I never really knew until years later when I got sober just how much of an impact that had on my life and the way I perceived myself. I had absolutely no idea until I got sober. So it should come no surprise to any of you that the very first time I picked up a drink, I drank to get drunk. And that's how I drank every single day. You know, I hear people in this program talk a lot about socialized drinking, and they started off slow here with wine, and then they progressed to this. Not me. Started off with tequila, and it got worse from there, you know. and that's just how it went. You know, I'll give you a couple of highlights. Yes, I actually did drive east on the westbound lane. Got pulled over. It was like at 1 o'clock in the morning. When the cop opened the door, I literally fell out of the car. That's how drunk I was. You know, that happened to me 3 more times in my drinking career, and I never once got arrested and charged with the DUI. You know, I understand today that that's a yet. You know, that is something that if I ever choose to pick up that drink, it is something I can guarantee I will go back to doing, only that time I probably won't be as lucky as I was early on. You know, my mother and father thought it would be a good idea to get me a savings account and a checking account. They thought maybe if, you know, we give him a little bit of responsibility, you know, maybe he'll run with it and be responsible. Oh, Jesus Christ. This is back when, you know, you could take a check and you could take it over to Pathmark and, you know, you could write the check for $100 and buy a pack of gum, you know, for like 50 cents and get the $95.50 back or the $99.50 back, you know. And they didn't have that little swiping thing, you know, that clears the money. It was kind of on the honor system. You know, so I bounced, I think it was somewhere around 30, 35 checks in a one-month period. Cost my mother and father $30,000 to almost $40,000 in legal fees, fines, and all kinds of other crap to settle that so I wouldn't get charged and go to jail for check fraud. Yeah, I was a charmer. I often think that if my mother and father knew then what or knew the day I was born what they knew at that point, they probably would have traded me in for a different model, you know. But that's how I behaved. I can't recall too many days where I was not drunk. I cannot recall too many days where I didn't wreak havoc everywhere I went. But I do recall one night that I was not drunk. And there was a group of us, probably eight of us, and we were getting ready to get into my little Ford Mustang hatchback. You know, we had five people packed in the back seat. I was in the driver's seat, had a couple people packed in the front seat, and we were on our way to Ashroken Beach up on Long Island. You know, and of course, the car was packed with booze, you know, because we were going to party and stuff at the beach all night long. You know, and if you know Ashroken Beach, it comes up high on a cliff, and then it goes down a really steep incline into a really sharp hairpin turn. I took that turn at about 50 miles an hour, sideswiped an oncoming car, and into the tree I went. You know, I often think today about what was going on in my mind the day that I did that, because I knew that I wasn't drunk that night. You know, and I don't know. I don't know if it was ego trying to get the best of me to show off in front of my friends, or was it something a lot worse? I don't know. And I still don't. But there's not a day that goes by that I'm not grateful that for some unknown reason that night we all chose to put our seatbelts on, especially those of us in the front seat, because that was not something we had ever done before. You know, we were reckless, and it was never going to happen to us. Always going to happen to you, but it was never going to happen to us. Of course, until it would. You know, excuse me one sec. My life progressed. It got so good, in fact, that the best job I could get was the graveyard shift at the 7-Eleven in a little rinky-dink town called Lake Ronkonkoma up on Long Island. And, you know, I got to tell you, I actually like that job. You know, it was the graveyard shift in a small town, so it wasn't like it was really busy, and I had all the free beer I wanted and all the food I wanted, you know? So when the 6 o'clock in the morning shift would come in, they would find me passed out. Most of the time, I was passed out in the cooler. Couple of times, I actually made it to behind the counter, but not very often. You know, and when Friday would come around and I would get paid, you know, I would see, like, my check would be $185 or whatever it was, but the actual pay too was like $1.60, $2.10, you know, because they thought it would be good that they would actually charge me for all of that beer and that food to the best of their ability of what they knew I took. Oh, good Lord. So my life is going along really swimmingly, as you can see. And I had a really good friend of mine. His name was Steven, and we had dated up on Long Island, and he had moved down here to Florida a few years previous to all of this. And out of the blue, he calls me, and he tells me that he's got this place up in Coconut Creek, and would I be interested in coming down to Florida and sharing the apartment with him? And I thought, well, sure. You know, I mean, I got nothing to lose. My life is going really great here. And actually, in my mind, it was. You know, I mean, I had this perfect job. I had all the booze, the food, and I didn't really have any kind of responsibility. So how could it get any better than that, you know? But I decided, okay, you know, let's give this Florida thing a shot. You know, and in my mind, it's like I'm really coming down here on vacation kind of a thing. And that's how I always looked at it. Because about 6 months later, I realized very, very quickly why Stephen and I didn't work out up on Long Island. You know, it didn't take really a long time to figure that out. You know, and there was no way that this was going to work. Two of us living together. And he knew this woman, Angela, that he worked with through this security company that they both worked for Stephen's brother in Deerfield Beach. And he introduced me to Angela, and she lived actually down close to downtown Fort Lauderdale, you know, off of Sunrise Boulevard and Northeast 15th, if you know that area well. And I decided to go down there and spend the weekend there, see if I could get a job, see if I could get along with Angela, if this place was going to be okay. And, you know, I got a job at the Moss Brothers Jordan Marsh at the Galleria Mall. You know, and so I figured that this was going to be a better change for me. And so off to Fort Lauderdale I went. Excuse me. You never really realize until hindsight, you know, after you get sober, that you can realize that, you know, even then there was a God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know, he was moving all of the pieces on the chessboard in the right direction. You know, because when Alec was ready, everything Alec was going to need was going to be available to him. You know, I worked in the Liz Claiborne department at Jordan Marsh. And was right next to the polo department where a guy named Bob Kay used to work. You know, and he and I worked the night shift. And so we used to go out, and I would ask him if he would drive us up to the bar, you know, because I needed a couple just to get through the night, you know. I mean, I was there at 11 o'clock in the morning. We were there till 8 o'clock at night. You know, I mean, by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I needed something to settle me down. And so, of course, that's where we went. You know, and I would have my couple of drinks, and he would always order a Coca-Cola. Now, just to backtrack a little bit, my mother and father had gotten sober a couple of, well, probably at this point about 7-8 years earlier. You know, and yes, up on Long Island, they had tried to introduce me to the program, and yes, they had some of their younger friends thinking that I would identify to all that stuff. You know, but at the end of the day, we're ready when we're ready, if we're ever ready. And by the grace of God, I was. So when Bob would order his Coca-Cola, I was kind of smart enough. Don't ask a question you don't already know the answer to, because that could really screw things up, you know. So I just figured I was going to let him do whatever it was he was going to do, and I was going to do my thing, you know, because that worked for me. And this went on for, oh, I don't know, a few months or whatever it was. And June 12th, 1990 was like any other day. You know, we had gotten up, and oh, again, backtrack a second. Through a series of personal issues, Bob ended up having to move out of the living situation he was in and ended up actually renting a room in Angela's house as well. So Bob and I were actually now living in the same house. So June 12th, 1990, like any other day, you know, got up, I took my shower, shaved, got ready for work. And right before I was ready to leave for work, I went into the bathroom, I took one look in the mirror, and I started to cry. You know, because at that point, you know, you understand that you can no longer do this anymore. You know, I just couldn't. And I had two choices. I was either going to get sober, because I knew that was an option, or I was going to take my own life. And I have to be honest, if I had the courage to take my own life, I probably would have done that, because I'm all about the easier, softer way. You know, and to me, you know, from the time I started drinking, 30 years old, that was a long enough life. I didn't need to really go much past that. I would be comfortable if I was dead at 30. So if I had the courage, I probably would have taken my own life. Needless to say, I was kind of a mess. Bob settled me down. Angela settled me down. You know, Bob called us both in sick to work that night. And I was going back and forth, you know, between, okay, you know, let's go to a meeting. You know, I'll try to say a thing, you know, because, of course, Bob was sober. That's why he was ordering the Coca-Cola. You know, and we were going back and forth all day. And I would get up and get ready to go, and then I would back out. And finally, you know, he decided, and we decided, that the 8:30 meeting was the meeting I was going to go to. So off to the Lambda Club I went. It was a Tuesday night. And I sat in the very back of the room. You know, and I was petrified. I mean, I swear to God, my heart was beating so fast, and so I could almost feel it jumping out of my chest. You know, I was terrified. I cannot tell you for the life of me what was said, what was talked about that night. I have no idea. But I do know at the end of the night, this guy got up there and he did this chip thing. And he talked about a white chip, and he said, if you want this and can start a new way of life, you can come up here and get it. You know, but there was no way my legs were going to get me to the front of that room to pick up that white chip. You know, I mean, I was so paralyzed with fear, you know, that there was just absolutely no way I could do that. And by the grace of God, he just simply said, you know what? I'm going to leave it up here on the table in case you're shy. You know, every day since then that I have ever been asked to do the chips, I will say that to somebody. I will leave it up here in case you're shy. You know, and about a month ago, a woman that was at a meeting with me, she came up to me and she said, you know, I don't really think that that's a good thing for you to do. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And she's like, leaving it up there if you're shy. You know, if they're really serious about this courage, they're going to find, or really serious about this program, they're going to find the courage to get up and get up there and pick up that chip. And while maybe she has a point, maybe, you know, it wasn't because I didn't want to get up there and pick up that chip, because God, I can tell you, I did. I just couldn't. You know, I just couldn't. And that's what I explained to her that night. You know, and she can see it, and she can work it, and she can do the chips however she sees fit, and that's fine with me. I'm okay with that. But I've been doing it this way since I got sober, and I'll continue to do it by the grace of God every day that I stay sober and I'm asked to do the chips from this point on. You know, and that's just for me. Bob, of course, being the chatty Cathy that he is, you know, I can't wait for this meeting to be over. I can't wait to get the hell out of there and get back home, you know. And he's just talking and talking and talking, and I'm sitting there thinking, I want to get them out of here, you know. But I see that white chip sitting up there on that front table. And so I decide that I'm going to sneak up there, and I'm going to be real slick, and I'm going to slide it off the table and put it in my pocket. And that's exactly what I did. And as soon as I did that, there were two guys standing right behind me, and both of them gave me... Shocker, right? Both of them gave me a big hug and a big kiss, and they said, you know, thank you so much. We can't wait for you to come back. And I instantly thought, well, what is it that you want? You know? Because those were the kind of people that I associated with. If you were inviting me back, it's because I had something you wanted. If I was associating with you, it was because you had something I wanted. You know? If you didn't, piss off. You know, that was my attitude with all of this. You know, so I couldn't understand it. You know, and I just kind of said thank you and I went on my way. You know, and I recalled not recently, because I heard somebody say this in a meeting and it reminded me of that day. You know, and one of them turned around and said, Alec, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is better with you in it. You know, and when I was at that meeting not long ago and I heard that person say that, it made me think about that moment. And today I could reflect on what a wonderful thing that was to say to somebody. So I can tell you that from this point on, if I'm chairing a meeting and there is somebody that picks up a white chip, I'm going to make sure that I write down their name. And before I close the meeting and thank everybody for their service, I'm going to try to make sure they understand that Alcoholics Anonymous is a better program with them in it. You know, because that's how this works. Oh, God, maybe a month goes by, and by this point, I'm making a couple of friends, you know, so we're all talking, and they're all talking about this sponsor thing, and I'm like, oh, God, you know, Jesus Christ, there's going to be work involved in all this, you know, but they're talking about it, and so I figured, well, okay, you know, I mean, I'll get myself a sponsor. So me, in all my infinite wisdom, I go up to the cutest guy in the room, and I ask him to be my sponsor. And he says to me, sure. And that's it. No phone number, no name, no nothing. Just, sure, I'd be happy to. You know, it turns out that he only had 6 months sober at that point. But what the hell do I know, you know? You know, because me, I'm thinking, well, if I got to spend time with this guy like all my friends were doing, and I got to talk to this guy, I figured, well, if I could get a little piece on the side then, you know? It's all about the practicality thing going on with me, you know? If I can kill two birds with one stone, I'm good. You know, it makes sense, doesn't it? Oh, God almighty. Some of us are sicker than others. Yes, I understand that. I don't know, another month or so goes by, you know, and I'm talking once again with my friends, and they're all talking about how they're starting the steps and stuff like that with their sponsor, you know? And I mean, and meanwhile, I've never spoken to James. You know, it was only like 2 weeks after I asked him to be my sponsor that I found out what his name was, for Christ's sake. And so, And so they're all talking about how they're doing the steps. So I'm thinking, well, okay, you know, I go up to James because we all go to the meeting. And I'm like, James, I'm like, you know, my friends are doing all the steps and stuff like that. What do you think? Maybe you and I can get together and start doing the steps. And he says to me, he's like, okay, that sounds like a great idea, but here's the thing. I'm only available on Wednesday night. Could have been Thursday, but it was one of those two nights. It was probably Monday or something like that, but who knows. And he says, and I'm at the Club 825, which ironically was the bar that Bob and I used to go to while we were at work. And I'm in the piano bar section, you know. Now, by no stretch of the imagination am I the smartest guy in the room, you know, at all. But even I was smart enough to know, like, this just does not make sense, you know. It's just something that just does not make sense about all of this. So the next night at the meeting, you know, I'm talking with all of my friends. You know, we're standing in the back of the room. And I'm talking and I'm telling them, I'm like, and I don't understand. I have no idea what to do. You know, I really don't know what to do, you know. And around the door comes this guy, Wayne. And he introduces himself to me and is like, Alec, I'm Wayne. It's very nice to meet you. And it sounds to me like you do need a new sponsor. And I said, well, okay, you know, that sounds great. And he's like, and I have the perfect person for you. And I said, great. I said, who is it? He said, well, that person would be me. I said, okay. And he said, now listen. He said, the first thing you need to do is you need to go over to James and you need to thank him for his service. Then you need to come all the way up to the front of the room and sit at the table next to me because that's where I'm going to be. And so I'm like, well, wait a minute. I'm like, why do I have to thank James for his service? He didn't do anything. He said, Alec, you're not thanking him because he did or he didn't do something. You're thanking him because he was willing enough to. What he might have done or what he might not have done wasn't necessarily a good thing, but that's all irrelevant. The very fact that he's willing to do something, that any one of us have a willingness to do something in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we should be thanked for that. You know, which is why I'm always at a meeting, and if ever I choose to share, I will always thank the chairperson for chairing the meeting, and I will thank everybody in the room for being there to make it a great meeting. Because even just attending a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're doing service and you're showing a willingness to participate in your own recovery, you know, and to serve others. And isn't that really what this is all about? You know, but I couldn't get that. I couldn't understand that. You know, so off to the front of the room I go after I go over to James and I thank him for his service, you know, and I let him know to the best of my ability, thank God for step 10, that he wasn't going to be needed anymore. You know, and so I go up and I sit next to Wayne. And he said, it's good to have you here. And I said, listen, Wayne, I said, I'm really comfortable sitting in the back of the room. He said, that may be so, but he said, I'm more comfortable up in the front of the room, and I think it would be a good place for you. And I'm like, well, why is that? He said, well, you know, Alec, it's been my experience that when I'm up in the front of the room, there's less distraction, and I can hear better. You know? I was not liking this at all. You know? Because I like sitting in the back because it was close to the door, and I didn't really have to participate in anything. You know, but that was not what Wayne had in store for me. So we're sitting there, and I'm just like, okay, Wayne, is there anything else? He said, yeah, now that you mentioned it, there are just a couple of other things for right now that I need you to do. And the first thing is you need to go to a meeting every single day. And I said, well, yeah. I said, I've been hearing about this 90 meetings in 90 days. No, 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 no. He said, no, that's not going to work for you. You need to go to a meeting every single day. And I'm like, for how long? You know, I mean, I'm thinking, oh, my God, what are you talking about here? And he slams his hand down on the table, and he's like, Alec, did you drink every day? And I was like, and there was no more of the sarcasm. Now it was, he was deadly serious. You know, did you drink every day, Alec? And I'm like, well, yeah, I did. He said, spend a lot of time in the bars, did you? Lose a lot of jobs, almost kill people. He didn't know anything about me or anything about my story, yet he understood me perfectly. Because, yeah, all of that kind of stuff was true. And he said, that's what I did. You know, these were things that I did. You know, I had to come to a meeting every single day. You know, that's what you're going to have to do, Alec. You know, this is about life and death. And that was the first time I ever heard alcoholism equated to life and death. You know, and if that's not what it is for you, maybe you're not ready to be here. That's something that you're going to have to ask yourself. maybe you're not ready to be here. You know, he really scared the living daylights out of me that day because I had never heard it put like that. I had never bothered to stop and look at all of my actions in that way. You know, number three, you have to call me every day, Alec. Oh, Christ. You know, yep, you have to call me every day. And you have to call me between 5 p.m. and 7:30. And I'm like, well, why between that time? He said, because that's when I'm home and that's when I can talk to you. You know, I get off at 4 o'clock. I get home by 4:30. I'm ready to talk to you by 5. At 7:30, I'm leaving for the meeting. That's at 8:30, and I'm hoping that I'll see you there. You know, so you have to call me every day. And I'm like, well, what happens if I got nothing to talk about? You know? And he said, you know, Alec, it's been my experience. You can take that. You know, but it's been my experience, Alec, that, hi, Wayne, how you doing? That's a great way to start a conversation. And who knows where it can go from there. You know, there was a lot of sarcasm, a lot of humor, but all of it was deadly serious. Because these things were very, very important. You know, he needed to hear my voice. He needed to talk to me every single day because he could tell just by the tone of my voice, by the sound of my voice, where my head was at. You know, he would know instantaneously. You know, so that's what I did. You know, eventually, a few months later, we would get started on the steps. He would keep me on step one for an entire year. You know, when I would say to him, like, you know, I don't understand why, you know, all of my friends are on like 3 and 4 and 5. He said, it's none of your business what anybody else is doing. He said, don't worry about them. He said, Alec, what I want for you is a very long, slow recovery. You know, and I really thought that he was being, you know, lack of a better word, a smart ass is how he said that. But what he was really telling me, Alec, is take your time, enjoy the journey, and smell the roses along the way, because it's incredible. And I wouldn't know that until I started this journey. You know, it is true what they say, like in the big book and stuff like that, that you do process all 12 of those steps. You do experience them in your first year. You know, but it wasn't until I could get it in my heart, honesty and acceptance here in my heart about who I was, because that was the most important thing. As long as I understood that in my heart, you know, my chances of recovery, my chances of surviving in this program were a lot better. You know, I do remember once, I was about 8 months sober, 9 months sober, give or take, and there was this show that was coming on, you know, and it was Noble House, and I had seen it before a few years earlier, and I really liked it. It was with Pierce Brosnan. I mean, who wouldn't like that, you know? I mean, come on, think about it. You know, and I really wanted to take the night off, so I remember calling Wayne and telling Wayne, I said, you know, I just want you to know that I'm going to take the night off tonight, and I'm going to stay home because there's this show on that I want to watch. And he's like, okay. He said, whatever you think is more important, Alec, click. Perfect. Got permission, you know? Didn't really understand the subtle message he was sending me. But you know, my higher power, which I didn't even know I had, has a funny way of poking at me to let me know. You know, and I'm sitting there, it's about 5 minutes to 8. I know the meeting is not starting until 8:30, so you know, I don't have to worry about it, but the show's coming on. It's about 5 minutes to 8, and I'm trying to get comfortable, you know, and I can't. You know, because all I keep thinking about is whatever you think is more important, Alec. You know? And so what I decided to do was patch a VHS tape into the VCR. Anybody who's under the age of 30 in here, I'll explain later what that is. And hit record. And off to the meeting I went. And when I went in and I walked all the way up to the front and I sat down next to Wayne, all he did was smile and say, you know what, Alec, I'm glad you have your priorities right. You know, that would be the very first time that I would make an absolute conscious decision to put my recovery first. You know, I've never found it necessary not to do that since. Ah. met somebody at just about a year sober, he would change my life. You know, he was in the program. He was the one who taught me about intimacy. He was the one who taught me that it was okay to laugh at myself. You know, at all of the stupid things that we do, you know, because we're human beings and we do stupid stuff all the time. You know, this point was to not take it so seriously. You know, changed my life in ways that I can't even begin to tell you. You know, and we had a great life. We built a great life together. He owned his own catering business. I was in the travel business. You know, we met a lot of wonderful people and very interesting people, traveled all over the world. Incredible opportunities for somebody like me who never thought in a million years it would be worth living past 30. You know, I didn't understand what life had, what was out there for me. Sober about 13 years, and my mother and father decided to retire and move down here. It wasn't but maybe 4 or 5 months after, my mother was re-diagnosed again with cancer. This time it was endometrial cancer. By the time we realized how bad it was, it had metastasized to just pretty much every organ in her body. And she had made a decision at that point to go home. Sorry. My father wasn't happy with that decision. You know, he was making my mother's life difficult. You know, so she had called me and she had asked me if I would talk to him. It's amazing that when you reach out for the power of God, when you reach into those 12 steps, they can give you strength and courage you didn't know you ever had. And I would have to have what was no doubt the most difficult conversation I would ever have to have with my father, because I would have to let him know that it wasn't his decision any more than it was mine. It was hers. You know, the treatment she was looking at was not going to be pretty, and that was not what she wanted for herself. And so my mother would come home, and my father and I would take care of her until she died. And it was a very quick death, which I'm truly grateful for today. You know, but through that whole process, I had an opportunity to mourn her death. And that's not to say that it wasn't devastating to me when she died, because she was my mother. Of course it was devastating. But there was an incredible sense of peace with it, you know, because she was at peace with the decision that she made. And she was finally not in any more pain. You know, and you can be grateful about that. Even in the worst of times, you can find a sense of peace and a sense of gratitude. 3 years later, Bernie would be diagnosed with cancer. And a year and a half later after that, he would pass away. And I thought that I would be able to mourn his death the same way that I mourned my mother's. You know, but after the dust settled, I was so angry. I had no idea how angry I was. I was pissed off at God. I hated him. I hated all of you in AA. I couldn't stand you. The life that you gave me back only to have it taken away. How dare you? You know, and that was the way that I looked at it. That was the way that I saw it. That is how I felt. And there was so much rage. And with rage come stupid decisions that have devastating consequences. You know, and it's always the people that are closest to you that get hurt the most. Some of them to this day won't even give me the opportunity to apologize. And that is okay, because I continue to make a living amends to the best of my ability, because that's what you taught me how to do. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't a lot of destruction, a lot of self-destruction going on, because there was. I made a decision because I thought that this would be good for me to get out of Florida, so I moved to Las Vegas. And we laugh about it, you know. But the truth is there had been friends of ours that lived out in Las Vegas that we had known for years and years and years and had always gone out to visit there. You know, so there was a rationale in picking Las Vegas. But at the end of the day, I mean, it was absurd and insane to think that somehow moving to Las Vegas, that all of this pain and angst was going to go away and all of this anger was going to go away. Took me about 6 months to unpack, get the last painting on the wall, fill the fridge with food, put the last dish away. You know, and I took one look at my dog and I said, oh, hell no, this is not going to work. And I started packing. And back home I came, still angry, still very angry. One day I decided, and I don't know why I do this, but I love to meditate behind strip malls. I like to just go in the back. That shit crazy. But it works for me. So there it is. But I went behind this strip mall not far from my house and backed in. And I just figured, okay, you know, because this is that moment of truth. You're either gonna give me the courage to do what I know I need to do, and that's to go back to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's always where the solution is, or I'm gonna drink. You know, because I was tired of feeling like this, and I was tired of living like this, and I couldn't take it anymore. And so I went home. At this point, I was living with my dad and my stepmother. Bitch. Well, did I say that out loud? Really sorry. Can we delete that, Karen? But anyway, she wasn't home. And I just looked at my dad and I said, I need a meeting list. I'm going to go to a meeting. And that night I went to the Wednesday night meeting, As Bill Sees It group in Coral Springs. And you know, as soon as I walked in that room, you know how, you know that feeling? It's just like, oh, thank God. You know, I'm home. And I did exactly what Wayne told me to do. And by the way, at this point, Wayne is no longer my sponsor. He chose to move out to Montana. Don't ask me why. Because I couldn't tell you. But Montana it is. And so what I did is I sat up in the front. And I kept my mouth shut and I just listened. You know, and that's what I did for the next few days. And I knew that I was going to need to get a home group, and I knew that I was going to need to get a sponsor. You know, and yes, I had a couple of trials and errors with a couple of sponsors just to see how things were going to work out. But, you know, it didn't. You know, and that was okay. You know, it wasn't the right relationship. You know, I really, truly believe that when it is the right relationship, you know it. You know it instinctively. You know it in your heart. You know, and there was this one gentleman that I had been watching. His name was Brian D. You know, when he was a lot like Wayne, he had a sense of humor with a little bit of sarcasm and a little bit of goofiness. But boy, oh boy, oh boy, did he understand Alcoholics Anonymous. Did he understand the 12 steps? Yeah, Lisa and Karen are like, oh yeah, we all know Brian. A little goofy, a little crazy, but boy, he knew what he was doing. You know, and he had worked a hell of a program. You know, and so I had asked him to be my sponsor. You know, and he said yes, and he said, let's meet and let's have coffee, and we meet and we have coffee. You know, when he says to me, he says, you know, Alec, what are you hoping for from a sponsor? You know, and I told him what I was hoping for. You know, and I told him how I was feeling, and he agreed to be my sponsor, and we started meeting on a regular basis once a week. You know, and every week we would talk, you know, and we would talk about the things that were going on, and he would make suggestions, and I would try them, and I was still going to meetings every single day. You know, there was none of this 90 and 90 in my head. I was going to a meeting every single day. You know, and I was just, and then I was talking with Brian every day, and we were meeting once a week, and that was good for me. That's what I needed to do. You know, and yeah, I was starting to feel a little bit better. You know, but there was still just something missing. There was something not right. You know, and I would talk to Wayne, and I suggested that, well, maybe he and I go through the steps again. And we were in the process of going through the steps, and every time, you know, we would talk about things, you know, he would talk about his experience in General Service District 9. You know, when he would talk about when he was a GSR, and then when he became an ACM, and then a DCM, and then a member of the Archives Committee and chair of the Archives Committee. And, you know, and each week he would get, always bring the conversation back to General Service, you know. And I remember saying to him, I'm like, that's not really going to work for me, because me and politics, we really don't mix all that well, you know. And to me, General Service just seemed like a place for politics. And, you know, and so it was not my cup of tea, you know. And Brian would say to me, he's like, well, you know, Alec, you can build your own sandbox there. You know, when you're in general service, you can decide who you're going to associate with, who you're going to talk with, who you're going to learn from, those kinds of things. You don't necessarily have to do it with everybody. You can pick and choose, and then all the rest of it, it's none of your business. Let them do what they're going to do, and you do what you're going to do, and you're going to be okay. You know, and he finally wore me down, and I was like, all right. I'm like, all right, you know, I mean, how is this going to work? He's like, well, you know, it just so happens that the GSR in your home group is going to have to step down for personal reasons. So when you're at your business meeting, you let them know that you would be interested in taking over where Daryl left off and becoming their GSR. And so that is what I did. And the group elected me their general service representative. And all I kept thinking is, like, you know, now what? You know, but I remember there was this other woman, and I know that she used to come to the lake a lot, and I know that over the last couple of times she hasn't been able to be here, but she'll be back, and that's Jamie M. And I knew that Jamie M. was really, really involved in general service. You know, and she was cutting my hair at the time. You know, so I remember talking to her one day when she was cutting my hair and talking to her about general service. And, you know, I'm not really sure about all of this kind of stuff, but I'm the new GSR. And she was, like, so excited. And anybody who knows Jamie, she gets, like, really crazy with that kind of stuff. Oh, my God, I can't wait to have you there. And, you know, when you come in, and this is what you're going to do, and all of that kind of stuff. And she's really making it sound fun, and she's freaking me out, actually. You know, but she said, you know, but I asked her, I said, you know, Jamie, I said, do you think it will be okay if, you know, when I get there, you know, that I sit next to you, because then this way, if I have any questions, she's like, absolutely, absolutely, when you get there. And she said, and remember, you know, this is when the next meeting is this month, and you have to be there at noon, because that's the GSR workshop before the actual business meeting, and we do that in District 9. And at that particular workshop, you're going to learn an awful lot about what it means to be a GSR. You know, and like anything in service, by the time you really figure it out, bye-bye, time to move on. You know, and yes, that's been my experience so far. But off to the district meeting I went, and I sat next to Jamie, you know, and when I didn't understand things, Jamie took the time to explain them to me. You know, and what I was doing is I was learning. You know, I found a new passion. It was something that I was missing. You know, and it was wonderful. And we were starting to go to quarterlies and stuff like that, and I was starting to learn a lot about general service and all the different committees and how the GSO office works and how AA works. And it was really fascinating. It was stuff that I never, ever knew and I never thought that I would need to know or would want to know, really. You know, and it was just, it was an incredible experience. And I was starting to make a lot of friends, and Victor and myself and Bobby and Sherry. Sherry is another person that I know that you guys all know a lot. And we would all drive up to the quarterlies together, and, you know, and we would have a lot of fun. And then when we got there, you know, we would always joke around on the way up. But when we got there, it was all down to business. We all went to the necessary meetings that we would need to go to. We took it very seriously. You know, because this was our opportunity to participate in a way that I never thought that I would be able to. You know, I'm carrying the message to the alcoholics who still suffers on such a broad scale. It was just it has been and continues to be an amazing experience for me. So I was learning, and like I said, you know, 2 years, first 2 years as GSR, that went by awfully fast. And I was starting to get a little bit nervous here, you know, because as a GSR, my group funded me, you know, and that was the only way that I could really go to these quarterlies. Otherwise, you know, they're hundreds of dollars if you don't have funding or you don't have financial assistance. You know, last name Wilbur, not Rockefeller yet, you know, so can't really afford to do that kind of stuff on my own, you know, and so I started thinking of ways that I could fund things and or get funded. And as I was rotating out, one of the things we do in District 9 is we do fund our ACMs, as long as there's not another ACM or DCM in that sub-district, you know, which, of course, there was no way to guarantee what sub-district I would get, so I couldn't really guarantee, as it was my turn to stand for ACM, that I would get funded. But I also knew that committee chairs got funded as well. You know, so I started looking at different committees, and it just so happened that right around this time, Sherry was rotating out of the Special Needs Committee, now the Accessibilities Committee. You know, and no one on her committee wanted to stand for chair, you know, and so I thought, well, okay, this sounds interesting. And I went up to Sherry and I was talking to her about the Special Needs Committee, and I was just like, you know, tell me about this, explain it to me. And she's like, you know, Alec, it would really be a great opportunity for you. It's not, It's not a really intellectual committee like maybe PICPC is. It's not really involved. It's a pretty simple committee, and it's not hard to navigate your way through. And she said, and I think you would do a great job with it. You know, and so I thought about it, you know, but there was something sitting in the pit of my stomach, you know, because something happens when we get sober. Something happens when we work these 12 steps. You know, we get a conscience. You know, when I started to think about my motives, I started to take a look at my motives, you know, and am I doing this for the right reason? You know, and it was really bothering me. So a couple of days before the district meeting that I would have to attend and stand to be elected, you know, I called Brian and I sat down and I talked with him about it, you know, and like he always did, he sat and he listened very intently, you know, and he just looked at me, he's like, Alec, he said, it really doesn't matter what gets you there. What matters is what you do with it once you've got it. You know, it's a lot like when we first come in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. What gets you here doesn't really matter. What you do with it once you're here is what matters. You know, and he applied that same philosophy to this, and that was a philosophy that I could understand. You know, and so at the district meeting, I stood and it became the special needs committee chairperson. By vote of the district, you know, and that December, and that was in October, and that December would be Sherry's last month, so she decided to have a meeting at her house, and she was going to turn all of the stuff from the committee over to me, and she was going to introduce me to all of the other committee members, and she was going to talk about the things that they had already done and all the things that they were getting ready to do, and one of those things, which they ran out of time to work on, was bringing meetings into ALFs, assisted living facilities, you know, and allowing, and for people who can't get to meetings that way, let's see if we can't bring the program to them, you know. But she didn't really get a chance to run with it, so I thought, well, there you go. That would be a great place to start, right? You know, and so January, I take over, and there was this woman who chaired the PICPC committee. You know, her name was Sharon G. I don't know if she's ever been here to the lake, but there are a lot of people that in this room that do know her. You know, and she was chair of that committee, and I remember, and this only goes to show you that, you know, when you're at these district meetings and these area meetings, how important it is to really listen to these reports, because this is how I learned about what it was she did. And one of the things, excuse me, that she does is every 3 months she meets with groups of nurses and professionals in the medical field and introduces them to what Alcoholics Anonymous actually is, you know? And so I thought to myself, well, maybe I could tag along with her. And while she's doing that, she can give me maybe 10 or 15 minutes and I can explain to these folks that if you have patients or clients, whatever you want to call them, it's fine with me, but need this assistance, well, you can call me and I can either get somebody to come pick them up and bring them to a meeting, or I can get a group of guys or gals and bring a meeting to them, you know? And that we teamed up to work on that project. And I'll never forget the first time I got a phone call from a nurse, you know, one of the nurses that had attended one of those functions that Sharon and I did together, you know, when she had a gentleman who needed some assistance, but he couldn't get out, so we had to bring it into him. Called a couple of my friends and said, hey, listen, let's bring this meeting to this guy. He could really use one. You know, to this day, over a year later, they're still bringing that meeting to that gentleman every Wednesday night. You know, and it's just an amazing thing, carrying the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, to have the passion to do that. It is the greatest thing we do every day. So my co-chair, Melissa, stood not just a week ago, this past Saturday, it'll be a week ago tomorrow, and she's going to rotate in as I rotate out in January, and I was able to do for her what so many people had done for me and took the time to explain about the committee, allow her to work on the committee, to run the show this past year, giving her the comfortability to stand for that position and be able to run with it, you know, which is what she's going to do starting in January of next year. You know, and her focus next year will be the blind and the deaf, you know, because there's always room for growth. I think about all of the people over the years that I've lost in this program. Some of them, like Brian, my sponsor, my mom, Bernie, that have all passed away sober by the grace of God. You know, but too many of them unfortunately didn't. You know, and I try to think of ways that I can honor them. And the best thing I can do is to continue to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And I don't know, come January, what that path is. God knows. And I'm going to put my faith in him, and I'm going to trust that he'll direct me in whatever area I need to go in. But that's what I'm going to do, because I know in my heart it's the single most important thing we do. And that is my challenge to all of you tonight. However you choose to carry the message, please do it. Because not only will you change your own life, you'll change someone else's. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak.